prepare yourself for the terror. The prison of madness, where few enter and none return.
Welcome to Unsung Horrors. With Lance. And Erica.
Leave all your sanity behind. It can't help you now.
Welcome to another episode of Unsung Horrors, the podcast where we review underseen horror movies, specifically those with fewer than 1,000 views on Letterboxd. I'm your co-host, Lance, joined by co-host, Erica.
Hey, everyone.
And before we dive into the film we're covering on today's episode, South by Southwest just wrapped up, and I wanted to quickly cover the online experience and chat about some of the films I was able to watch in the 5 days it was running.
So full disclosure, folks, this is I did not watch any of the films for South by, but Lance is going to be sharing some of his thoughts, though I know some stuff about a couple of the movies, and so I might have some questions about those. But if you don't want to hear about South by Southwest, I don't think Lance is going to be spoiling them, but if you just want to skip straight to the movie that we're talking about today, go to the timestamp in show notes and you can skip right to that.
Cool. Yeah, I'm definitely not going to spoil anything. I'm just going to give some of my thoughts and just my opinions on some of them. So no spoilers here. These movies aren't released, so I don't want to do that.
Okay.
So yeah, the festival was all digital this year, which is the first time for South by. And you could view films, panels, conference sessions, even musical showcases all online. So I installed the South by Southwest online app to my Apple TV, and I was able to watch 14 features, which was pretty good. I don't know how many were programmed, but I started late when it started on March 16th, and I just kind of really powered through it during the weekend. I did miss being in the theater, you know, sitting and chatting with friends and like staying for Q&As with the filmmakers. And kind of just the all around activity of like walking around and shuttling to different venues and crowds. But, you know, it's COVID. So I really enjoyed how easy it was to, quote, get into and watch every movie that I wanted. The setup was real easy, actually, I could just go do a quick rundown. But basically, you had to register to the movie you wanted to watch. You did that online by logging into your account. And it was pretty much available. Like if you forgot to register for a movie that was programmed to play that day or was released that day, I should say, you could just jump online, register, and basically you had permission within about half an hour. So I usually just registered to the movies I wanted to watch the night before. I got the okay email that morning of, and I could just start watching those movies whenever I wanted. It didn't have to be necessarily that day. So the setup was cool. And I've been a screener for the last 3 or 4 years now. So a few of the films I screened were actually programmed this year. So I'm just going to go over those. Three of them were programmed. One was called The Fallout, which was my favorite screener that I watched. I guess this was late last year. This actually won Best Narrative Feature, Audience and Jury Awards. So it was definitely the best movie voted by the people watching it and by the actual jury, Best Narrative Feature of the festival. Now, I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd, but it's a really impressive debut from an actress, actually. Her name is Megan Park, but this was her first time directing. It's about a school shooting and how students kind of cope afterwards. It sounds really depressing, but it's done in a way that's kind of hopeful. Yet it's still like very sad seeing how these kids' lives and views on the world are kind of forever altered. But it does have like an uplifting story. The main actress is a young girl named Jenna Ortega, and she is definitely going to be a star, in my opinion. She just was her acting was just incredibly real. It was good. But that's called The Fallout. I don't know any of the release dates for these, so I'm not going to give them. But I definitely recommend The Fallout. Another screener I watched was The Drover's Wife, The Legend of Molly Johnson, which was based on some sort of Australian true story of like some pioneer woman. It was fine. The director, Leah Purcell, directed it, wrote it, starred in it. And then another screener that was programmed, The Spine of the Night, which was a midnighter. And this is an all animated, really badass cartoon. Think heavy metal, same type of animation. But the story was terribly ambitious and it was just confusing. I really could not tell you what it was about. It was basically like Lord of the Rings, kind of like heroes stopping evil from overtaking the world. But it had great gore, but without a story, there was only, I kind of got over just watching a cool looking cartoon that just didn't have much going on.
Would it make more sense with drugs?
Oh yeah. I mean, everything makes more sense. At least I should rephrase that. Every cartoon seems to make more sense. I do recommend it. I want to watch it again because, I mean, I think I've said this before, you know, how you kind of rate a movie or feel about a movie is kind of like in the whole mood you're in of the day. So I was going to give it a rewatch, but I kind of wanted to make sure I got in as many movies I hadn't seen during the festival. But Lucy Lawless voices the main character, also has voices by Richard Grant, Patton Oswalt, Larry Fessenden, and Joe Magnamaglio, how Pee-wee says it, I do recommend it. A lot of people seem to like it. The art is just badass. But again, it's like over an hour and a half of just some kind of just a story that's a little too ambitious for it. So yeah, then these are the films I actually watched during the festival. I'm just going to run through these. The first one was a documentary called Disintegration Loops. And it covers a composer named William Basinski. He did four albums called The Disintegration Loops. And these albums are just these ambient sounds that kind of feature recordings of tape loops that gradually deteriorate each time they're played. And then the initial recording coincided with the September 11th, which Basinski witnessed from his studio rooftop in Brooklyn. So a lot of, you know, it was made during COVID, you could tell. It was not necessarily well made because you can see the obvious limitations due to the pandemic, but it worked. It kind of worked in a weird experimental way with what the subject was. So there's just kind of talking heads and people doing Zoom calls, which is kind of, you know, it's not fun to watch, but composer Basinski is like captivating as hell, whether, you know, it's just listening to him chat about his life, you know, him creating these sounds and pulling these shortwave radio frequencies that he just pulls from the air and starts looping. What was really fascinating too is because it was happening around September 11th. So many people at that time, you know, that's when he made these tapes. So many musicians like all across the world were kind of shocked, especially people in the US. And they didn't really want to listen to, you know, music with lyrics or something, just kind of tone out and think. And I think that's why it became so successful, like in the underground, like ambient sounds. But I recommend it. It's only like 45 minutes too. So it's super quick. I guess I wouldn't consider it a full feature, but it kicked ass. I liked it a lot. Okay. Then I watched a horror movie called Gaia. Okay. This one was fun. It was a midnighter. Visually, it was awesome. The story kind of gets away from itself, but it was basically Matango meets Joel Peter Witkin, and Matango's that old Ishiro Honda movie with like, you know, the mushroom people and stuff. And then Joel Peter Witkin does like these crazy setup photographs of, you know, people missing limbs or deformed people or cadavers. And artistically and visually, like it was very just eye candy. Like a lot of the scenes you could just like, you know, hang on a wall. But yeah, I've never played the video game The Last of Us. I started it a long time ago, like the first one, but a bunch of reviews apparently compared it to the storyline of The Last of Us and Annihilation, which I could see. I loved Annihilation, and this has a lot of that, where it's just kind of people being overcome by nature. And, you know, it definitely has a horror element, but it's very slow. Just some really cool, like, humanoids running around through the forest, freaking people out.
Okay.
Oh, and then the main actress, her name was Monique Rockman, who she was badass. She's a great actress. She didn't have much on her resume, but I did see that she was in a movie called Number 37. That was a South African movie, which is what this is, that played at South by Southwest 2018. And that's kind of like a retelling or a different version of, Alfred Hitchcock's Rear Window. And she's really good in that, and she's really good in this. So everything I've seen from her has been great. Then I watched something called Bantu Mama, which is about a woman who's arrested for smuggling drugs, and she escapes when the police car she's being transported in is involved in a wreck. And these kids find her and help her, and she kind of becomes a mother figure to them while attempting to flee the country. It was fine. I enjoyed it. But it was just, you know, just kind of like a little drama, kind of like a feel-good drama. Then the next day I dove into the very lengthy Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched.
Okay. Yeah. This is one I've been looking forward to. So what did you think?
It was good. It was really good. It's a history of folk horror directed by Kayla Janice.
Yeah.
Kayla Janice. Okay. This one, Audience Award for Best Midnighter, which is, you know, I've seen, there's a lot of documentaries that have been programmed in the past for, as Midnighters, but it's interesting that a documentary would win for Best Midnighter for South By, which I think is completely deserved based on the Midnighters I did watch. Mm-hmm. I think I watched about four of them. It's, you know, incredibly well put together. So much information. To me, I mean, I don't know folk horror very well. I mean, after watching this, obviously, I'm not real acquainted with it, because they kept pulling descriptions and examples of folk horror basically from every horror film. So to me, it was more of a documentary, a very well put together documentary on just horror in general.
Okay. I think Kayla Janice is also part of the Miskatonic Institute of Horror Studies, and they did she had like a panel of people who are like folk horror people, folk horror experts. I want to say it was last year. I can't remember exactly when. And it was interesting to me because, you know, the sort of definition being much more broadened outside of, you know, the sort of trifecta of the three movies that everyone associates with folk horror. So I was really looking forward to this. I know Severin is putting it out. I'm sure I'll buy it because I want to support Severin and I want to see the documentary. That'll probably be the first documentary that I actually own that isn't a special feature on a movie Blu-ray, just because like I don't ever rewatch documentaries. I don't think I ever have watched a documentary more than once.
Yeah, because I think I own one. I think I own Pretty as a Picture, the David Lynch, like covering all his art.
Well, I can see that, yeah.
and like his filmmaking. But yeah, this one I think is worth owning. I would recommend picking it up. And it's one I'd probably pick up too, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of extras probably, hopefully. I would love to see a companion book published for it, because this is like a book I would pick up, you know, like Bleeding Skull or the Swedish Sensations films, like go through a bunch of the movies that, you want to watch and read about them. A lot of people were creating letterbox lists of all the movies covered. So there are letterbox lists out there that cover, like, I think there's 200 films or something that's mentioned.
Ooh, wow.
So it's, like I said, it's a lot to take in. I actually did it in one sitting, you know, breaking it up. I think either way, I mean, it's just so much information. And I did beef up my watch list watching this thing.
Nice.
And then I watched Jacob's Wife, which is another Midnighter. This is from Travis Stevens, who directed Girl on the Third Floor, I think it was called, which premiered at South By 2019, 2 years ago. And I attended that, the premiere for that. That stars CM Punk, the wrestler, any wrestling fans out there, but his real name is Phil Brooks. He's also in this. He has a small role as a cop. He's kind of the added humor element. But it's a vampire flick starring Barbara Crampton and Larry Fessenden. And Barbara Crampton's just amazing in it. I watch anything with her, and she just puts on a great performance. I think pretty much everybody that have read about this or are interested about it know that she's a vampire in it, and she just delivers. Really good gore, great practical effects. It had a Shudder logo when it started, so I'm assuming it's going to be added to Shudder at some point.
Okay.
But it was good. It was good. I enjoyed it much more than Travis Stevens' debut, Girl on the Third Floor. I watched another documentary called Luchadoras, I usually always kind of watch anything that's wrestling related at these festivals, you know, Fantastic Fest or South By. This one takes place in Juarez, Mexico. It doesn't have very much wrestling at all, which is fine because like these ladies have really compelling life stories. Most of them, Juarez, Mexico is, you know, one of the highest crime cities in the, like in the world, as far as murders go. And apparently most of the murders are women. So it's these really strong women that are just kind of fighting for their kids to have a great life, trying to, most of them are trying to move, you know, out of Juarez into Mexico City to kind of pursue their wrestling career. But they all have kind of like odd jobs. One of them, I believe, was a mortician. Yeah, a lot of them just worked, you know, just regular jobs, but not a lot of wrestling if you're looking for wrestling. And the wrestling matches that are shown are very slow motion, kind of the same stuff over and over again. But again, it was fine. I recommend all these movies. And then probably my favorite at the festival was a movie called Swan Song. And that starred Udo Kier.
Yay.
And he is so good in this. He plays a retired hairdresser who's living in an assisted living facility. When one of his old, rich, conservative clients passes away, and in her will, she asks that he do her hair one last time, because it's an open casket. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the story of him. He never had a really, he had a good relationship with her in that he did her hair, you know, while she was alive, but she was very conservative, and he was married, and she did not approve of him, thinking she didn't approve of his lifestyle at all, you know, his husband or anything like that. But it's just him kind of returning to his town as he kind of remembers, you know, his husband who passed away from AIDS, and all that he kind of lost and gained throughout his life. It's just this great him kind of looking back at life. Again, Udo Kier, I think, is amazing in it. It's probably my favorite of the festival. I probably enjoyed it more than The Fallout.
Wow. Okay. That's awesome. Like, so Udo is I'm aiming to make him my top watched actor for this year. Yeah. It's been a little rough so far because I haven't done any rewatches yet. I've only been watching stuff I haven't seen with Udo in it. And I've got some stuff like, you know, some bootleg stuff that from the 70s that I can get to, but I've been trying to get through some of the rough stuff. And I watched a movie called Children of Wax, which he plays a serial killer who kidnaps and murders kids and then dips them in wax to turn them into dolls. And it's awful.
Oh,
and it's like,
it just sounds so good.
I know. It sounds like, wow, if there was ever a movie for Erica, it's got child murder and Udo Kier. Like, and no, it just doesn't. So I hope that that movie, or, you know, hits streaming at some point this year so I can add that to my list.
Anything with Udo Kier, yeah, I'll watch too. And Swan Song, I'll watch again when it's released. It's just like a dark comedy, pretty much. But it's very touching. It slays. Watch it.
Okay.
Okay, then I'll jump into one. It's an Irish thriller. I think this was a midnight or two, called Here Before. And it stars Andrea Riseborough. And she's from, you know, Possessor.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
Mandy, and she's great in it. I think she's a fantastic actress. She's just as, you know, powerful as those roles. Possessor's probably my favorite of the three that I've seen her in. But this was about a mother. She plays a mother whose daughter passed away years ago, and a family moves in next door to her. And she has a family too. She has an older son, a teenage son, and her husband. And this family moves next door, and they have a daughter. And she becomes obsessed with this little girl, believing that it's her dead daughter. And it becomes, I was really invested on this like psychological, like what's going to happen? What's going to turn, you know, what is this going to turn into? And I was just vibing hard on it. And then the last 20 minutes hit and it just ruined all the built up atmosphere and tension that I'd had. Aww. It just kind of, I felt like it dumbed down the story, and I wanted something different. A lot of people seem to like where it went. I was expecting and wanting something completely different. I didn't feel the ending at all.
Okay.
But it's beautiful, like solid photography, great performances, but man, bummer of an ending.
Okay.
Another documentary I watched, Alien on Stage.
Ooh, I want to see this one too. Okay.
Loved it. you know, the folklore one's great, but this was probably my, I enjoyed this documentary the most out of all that I watched. It's about of a lot of people probably seen the story, like, you know, it circulated on a lot of social medias while it was happening, but it's like this amateur dramatics group from Dorset, England, and they put together this theater production of Alien. And they kind of, one of the kids, they're all, a lot of them are related, like the director, his wife played Ripley, their son actually wrote the screenplay for this. He wants to be a writer, and he's this young kid who kind of, you know, did a revamp for a theater production of Alien. All the actors are quite old, which is really fun to watch. And they all work at the same place. They all work, it was like a bus driving company. In Dorset, like they drove buses or they, you know, they work like a switch station or something, but they did a great job. I kind of show most of the, you know, just kind of like the highlights of, I guess, the best scenes. They flip genders in a lot of roles. Like there's a female Ash and Parker, but yeah, they do one play locally in Dorset County, which is this tiny little town, and it didn't go well, but somebody caught wind of this and they actually were able to put on one performance. Somebody financed and put on a performance for them, like in this legit London West End theater. And all of them were like, oh my God, this is a dream come true. I've always wanted to be an actor and that's where I wanted to perform. Mm-hmm. So it's completely endearing. Yeah. Recommend that. I'm sure that'll be coming out hopefully this year soon.
Okay.
Then I watched The Feast, which was another midnighter. Welsh horror, super slow. Probably my least favorite horror or midnighter, honestly. It's about a well-off family preparing a dinner, and this mysterious woman shows up who they think she's the hired waitress, and she's weird and starts doing all these disturbing things to the family members and guests that throughout the evening, and it gets really dark. It sounds like a cool premise, but I found it just kind of forgetful and boring. I don't even remember how it ended. the main actress I remember was really great in it, who plays this, you know, hired hand, but it's just slow. It was a little too slow for me. Again, a lot of these movies I watch, like I would start at like 2 a.m. because, you know, and I got in this habit, like I'm going to watch another movie before I wake up in the morning. Okay. Then I watched a short called The Mugai, which was a 15-minute Australian short. It's a horror movie. This one actually won the jury prize for best midnight short. Hmm. It's about a couple that brings a newborn baby home, and a ghost kind of haunts the couple. I forgot what the ghost was called, like a budgelung, something Australian. I forgot what it was called. But they seemingly want to, this ghost wants to seemingly take the baby away from the parents. So they kind of escape it, and only they can see it. It's pretty haunting, beautifully shot. I don't know. I mean, I know, like, you know, Shudder, and I don't know who else might pick up. They've been picking up shorts and playing them. So Paul Dude's Deadly Lunch Break. This was my least favorite of the whole festival. It's just this mean kind of British humor. I tried to get into it, but the humor was just kind of too mean for me. And then it kind of switched gears at about 40 minutes in. And I was like, okay, let's see where this goes. Mm-hmm. But it was about a middle-aged guy who lived and cared for a sickly mother. And he wants to win a national, kind of like an American Idol type talent show. But he misses the audition due to a bunch of assholes who kind of slow him down getting there. And when he misses his audition, he goes back to take revenge on all those people throughout the town that slowed him down. Like, it sounds cool, but I didn't think it held up well.
Okay.
But check it out anyway. Paul Dude's Deadly Lunch Break.
You just said it was your least favorite.
Hey, everybody has different opinions. I mean, I'll recommend everything to people, but okay, this one was my least favorite by far. I think I gave it one star on
Why would you recommend it then?
I saw people that I follow that were giving it like 3.5, and I'm like, okay, well, maybe it's just me. Okay, so another documentary I watched next, Without Getting Killed or Caught, which was about Austin musicians Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark, and Guy Clark's girlfriend, Susanna, kind of told from Susanna's perspective, but, you know, they're all passed away, but I guess they kind of pulled... she had a lot of tape recordings that they pulled, that she kept. but it was narrated by Sissy Spacek. It was interesting. I mean, it was fine. Nothing like that blew me away. It was something that, you know, you'd watch like on PBS or something. I mean, it was, but it was good. It was fun.
All right.
I recommend it. Introducing Selma Blair was another documentary. She was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 2018.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And this kind of, this follows all the treatment she goes through, including stem cell therapy. It's emotional as you see her like in her really bad moments during the disease, you know, like her whole body breaking down and she can't talk. And also like, you know, she has a son and how it affects her time and a relationship with her son. But it's still uplifting because her attitude is so kind of, she's going to beat this, you know, and she's going to help people, you know, that are dealing with this disease and other diseases kind of to help them persevere. And it was good. It was good. A lot of people seem to love it more than I did. I mean, I'm not like a huge fan of Selma Blair. She's great. She's fine. But I don't really watch her movies or anything like that. So
yeah, same.
But yeah, I think that was a Discovery Plus, I think. So it's going to be streaming, I think, if you do Discovery Plus, which I think does all like the Chip and Joanne shit.
The what? Binge.
Chip and Joanne Gaines stuff.
I don't know who that is.
They're that couple that do like renovation. They're from Waco. They have that Magnolia. I don't know. I know all this because Sarah watches it. Okay. I don't sit there watching people. But apparently, I think they have a lot of like shows that they're producing. They created some sort of production company. Introducing Selma Blair is not part of it, but all of their shows are on Discovery Plus. So I saw Introducing Selma Blair was part of Discovery Plus.
Okay.
Yeah, that got confusing and stupid. Okay, so the next one is Off Season, which was a midnighter. This one was cool. It's about a woman who receives a letter requesting her presence into the small, very underpopulated island where her mother is buried because her mother's grave's been vandalized. So she and her boyfriend head out there, and it's basically Stuart Gordon's Dagon, based on H.P. Lovecraft's The Shadow Over Innsmouth. So it's this exact kind of same premise. Obviously, it's not executed nearly as well, but it's very atmospheric. I think it would have benefited like Dagon, like on a bigger budget with like more. I want more monsters and more tentacles, please. I liked it. It's just this kind of muted Lovecraftian tale.
Okay.
Then I watched a few shorts. Stuffed, which won the best short.
Is that the taxidermy one?
It is.
Okay.
Have you seen it or heard about
it? No, I've heard about it though.
So this was like, I had noted that this is like the best and shortest Masters of Horror episode ever/never made. Because it's really well done. I got the vibe of a whole Masters of Horror episode. I want to say it was like 25 minutes or so. But yeah, it's a musical, very much like Sweeney Todd, about a taxidermist who dreams of stuffing a human. And she meets a man online who's very interested because he doesn't want to grow old and die and age. But they kind of fall in love during the short time they're together while preparing for this procedure. A lot of fun, really well made, great songs. And basically, it's just two people. Their performances are really good, but the taxidermist, she's like amazing to watch. Do recommend that when that comes out. Then little shorts that are just fun to mention. One called Flick, which is about a guy who picks his nose and a booger is stuck to his finger and he can't get it off. So he starts coming up with all sorts of shit. I mean, he's going to cut that finger off. He's going to burn his place. I mean, it's kind of fun to watch him going mad.
Oh my God.
That's so stupid. It is stupid. And then I watched an animated short called Rendang of Death, which I think was Indonesian. This was the last day where I was kind of like, okay, I'm just gonna, they hadn't cut everything off yet. So I was kind of just racing through a couple of shorts. This was about like just a bunch of people in a restaurant, and rendang, I guess, is some sort of meat meal, like maybe a beef, or I think it could be lamb, but apparently it's very well known in wherever this, I think it was Indonesia. And this restaurant runs out, so everybody fights for this last piece, and you know, they're killing each other and bringing out flamethrowers, and that was a lot of fun to watch. And that's it. It was fun. I like I said, I missed the in-person experience of South by Southwest, but Sarah enjoyed it. You know, we got to watch a lot of these movies together. Yeah, I mean, it would be cool if there was always an online option, but I know that's, you know, that's not what the experience is about.
Right.
But I like how it was handled. I like how you can kind of watch whatever you wanted at any time.
Yeah. Maybe that'll be an option for Fantastic Fest. Like, by that time, they'll be like, we're going to do a hybrid kind of thing.
Because I know for Fantastic Fest, I feel like the movies were up for 24 hours or 48 hours.
Yeah, it was 24 or 48. I can't remember.
Yeah, I feel like it was a day. And I really liked how South By was basically, okay, here's the premiere time. And it's going to be on until the end of the festival, which was March 20th. Mm-hmm. So it could have premiered on the 16th. Or when I guess there's a set number of views per movie. And I never experienced hitting a lockout due to views. So, okay.
Folks, we will have another sort of similar to this episode in October, November, post Fantastic Fest, whatever that may look like. We'll know when we get closer to that time, whether we'll be there in person or watching movies virtually again. But in the meantime, we have a movie to get to, and Lance, it's your pick. Yeah. What are we talking about today?
All right. My pick. This episode, we're covering Blood Song, aka Dream Slayer, from 1982.
I told you this place was giving me nightmares. I keep seeing some lunatic killing people. I'm scared.
You're crazy.
Don't say that.
Multiple fractures, left leg. Severe concussion, blood type O positive. That's rough to come by. Do we have a sufficient supply?
Yes, doctor.
Do you think I did it on purpose?
If you hadn't been so drunk and run into that car, I wouldn't be a cripple now, would I?
The donor is a patient at the state mental hospital.
Some guy killed one of the orderlies and escaped from the crowded hospital.
You mean the loony bin? Hmm? That's in Corvallis County, right? Out of our jurisdiction, right?
Hey, where you headed?
San Francisco.
Jesus Christ. We've been playing that same thing for over an hour. Don't you know anything else?
I told you my daddy made this for me just before he died. You're just like all the rest. They tried to take it away from me too, but I got it back.
It currently has 326 views on Letterboxd with a 2.7 rating. You can find it on YouTube. So if you want to watch it before I dive into this spoilerific summary, have at it. But for those who want to watch it, or those who have watched it or want to experience it vicariously through me and Erica, here we go. Blood Song. Portland, Oregon, 1955. A man arrives home from a trip to find his wife is sleeping with another man. He shoots and kills his wife, as well as her lover, and then kills himself while his young son watches from the doorway. As soon as the father commits suicide, the kid starts playing a wooden flute. Jump to 27 years later, and we're now in Stanford Bay, Oregon, in 1982. We meet young high school student Marion Hauser, who is asleep in her bed. She opens her eyes and seems to be dreaming awake, hearing a flute playing, and watching a man, who is called Polly in her dream, strangle an orderly to death in what looks like a hospital. The killer, who we'll call Paul from here on, with a flute in hand, runs out of the building while an alarm rings. So the alarm wakes Marion up from her weird dream, and as she gets out of bed, we see that she is handicapped, requiring a leg brace to walk. And during breakfast, we're introduced to Marion's parents, her mom, who seems sweet, and then there's her asshole dad, Frank, who begins to rail on her about staying out late and telling her to stay away from Joey, the boy she's seen. Marion heads off to school, and afterwards she heads to the dock where her boyfriend, Joey, works on a boat as a fisherman. He tells her that he's going to take a test for a job in Portland so that they can run away together. Marion tells him about these weird dreams she's been having about a lunatic killing people. On her way home, she hears a flute playing and sees a van barreling towards her, causing her to jump out of the street. When she looks up, there is nothing there, implying that maybe she's seeing things that aren't real. Later that night, she has another vision while reading a book. This time, it's the escaped lunatic Paul, hitching a ride from a guy in a van that looks like the one Marion saw trying to hit her. She snaps out of it and goes downstairs for supper, where we learn that her dad is the one who actually caused her to be, as Marion says, a cripple. He was drunk one night and got into a car accident, which left Marion unable to walk without the leg brace. As they argue, Marion runs out the door and heads to the dock, and we get a flashback scene as she's staring at the water. It's of her in a hospital bed right after her car accident. The doctors are discussing her injuries and are requiring a blood transfusion, and it's mentioned here that the blood donor is from the local state mental hospital. Joey pulls up on a boat, interrupting the flashback, and Marion begins to tell him about the dream she's having again about this lunatic killing people. He thinks it's just stress and her mind is just playing tricks on her. And as soon as he gets that job in Portland, everything is going to be all right. While at school the next day, Marion has another vision of Paul the lunatic. He's riding in the passenger seat of that van and he's playing his flute. The driver is sick of him playing the same song, but that's the only song Paul knows because, quote, "I told you my daddy made me this just before he died. He didn't have enough time to teach me anything else." The annoyed driver pulls over to take a leak, and as he's mumbling to himself, Paul takes a hatchet to the driver's face and kills him. Then we quickly meet the sheriff, who is told that some lunatic killed an orderly and escaped from the mental hospital, which he just casually shrugs off since it's not in his county, and he decides to take a nap in his office. now that Paul has killed the owner of the van, he's now driving it, and he picks up a hitchhiker who was heading to Stanford Bay, where Marion lives. It's here that Paul has his first flashback of his father killing himself. Marion then has another vision of Paul the lunatic in the hotel room with the hitchhiker he picked up. They just finished getting it on, and he surprises her with a necklace that he bought from the gift shop. He starts playing his flute and weirdly talking about her and him going to San Francisco to take in all the sights. She tells him his flute playing sucks, and she definitely is not going to San Francisco with him. So he chokes her to death. And Marion wakes up screaming. And that next day she takes a walk. And we're provided with 2 minutes of the weirdest original song. And I'll get to that later. It makes no sense and doesn't fit the movie at all. But the tune is quickly interrupted. Well, I guess after 2 minutes. Hmm. When Marion sees that van parked off the beach. As she limps over, she sees Paul the killer burying the hitchhiker he murdered the night before. And an awkward foot chase starts, but it quickly ends when Marion runs into her high school friends who all have rifles for some reason. Later, Marion tells her boyfriend, Joey, about seeing the lunatic, and they head over to the beach where she saw him burying the body. But all Joey can find is buried trash, making out that Marion is perhaps a little crazy. That night, as the police find the head of the murdered hitchhiker, giving us some decent gore, Marion is dropped off at home by Joey, and her father's waiting inside. He slaps her around a bit for making out with Joey, and as she heads upstairs and her mom heads out to a PTA meeting, we find that Paul had followed Marion home. So Paul breaks into the house and violently attacks and kills her dad with a hatchet, hacking him apart as Marion does her best to run away. Marion runs into a sawmill because apparently there is no one else alive and who can help in this town. And Paul chases her into the factory. He begins to play the flute as he follows her through the sawmill, laughing like a madman and telling her how everyone thinks she's crazy. Paul then jumps into a forklift and impales a night watchman who popped up literally 10 seconds before this. The sawmill chase goes on for like a good 20 minutes until it ends with Marion jumping on Paul while he's driving the lift, shouting that she hates him and she's going to kill him. As they struggle, Marion jumps off the forklift and Paul crashes through the wall and off the dock into the water. The police show up and Marion starts talking about killing the man she's been dreaming about, sounding a little nutty to them. So she tells them that the man she killed murdered her father and a bunch of other people. Back at the sawmill, the police retrieve the forklift from the water, and they find a body. It's Bill, the night watchman. Cut to a car driving down the road, picking up a hitchhiker. We see the driver is Marion's boyfriend, Joey. And as the hitchhiker thanks him for the ride and he's getting into the car, it's revealed that it's Paul the killer. Marion, seeing this vision of Joey picking up Paul, the lunatic, is screaming her head off. The doctors are strapping her down and sedating her as she's yelling for help. Again, she's perceived as crazy. As the nurse downstairs is calling a doctor to check on her, we see a doctor wearing a white coat pass by, grabbing Marion's clipboard. He walks into Marion's room, and she turns to him, screaming in horror. As the camera slowly pans up, it's Frankie fucking Avalon. It's Paul the Killer. Hello, Marion, he says, and belts out a laugh that would put Mark Hamill's Joker left to shame. So it's a little weird. It sounds very convoluted when I'm summarizing it, but it's kind of a straightforward story of this girl getting in a car wreck, her getting a blood transfusion. The donor is a madman from the state mental hospital, and she can see his visions.
Yeah.
All right, let me jump in the crew. The crew and cast, I mean, there's some good names and some good information, but most of them have TV credits, so it's pretty short. So it's directed by Alan J. Levy. It looks like it's spelled L-E-V-I. It could be Levi, but I listened to an interview with him, and they called him Levy. Bloodsong has a very made-for-TV movie feel, and it could be due to Levy's touch, because all his other directing credits are TV series or made-for-TV movies.
Okay.
Except one where he's uncredited as co-director, and that's Battlestar Galactica from 1978. But he did direct a couple of Battlestar Galactica TV series episodes in that same year. But he directed a ton of episodes for well-known series from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, including, this is a good list, The $6 Million Man, The Incredible Hulk, Airwolf, Miami Vice, Magnum P.I., Quantum Leap, Columbo, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, ER, and NCIS. And those are just a few names that I picked from his resume.
Are you mad that he directed ER and not Chicago Hope?
Well, I mean, obviously.
And there's no soap operas on that list. I mean, God.
So there's some soap operas come up later on.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he's definitely a go-to director for like television series for decades. And it looks like he's still working on a TV series that's in pre-production right now. It's called Unfinished Business. So Alan J. Levy's still kicking it.
Okay.
And his TV movies are kind of all over the place with nothing really kind of standing out other than Knight Rider 2000 TV movie from 1991, which was made 5 years after the series was canceled. And basically it's David Hasselhoff as Michael Knight in the future. And another TV movie directed is a sequel to The Stepford Wives called The Stepford Children from 1987. And he also directed Michael Ironside, Bruce Stern, and country star Randy Travis in the made-for-TV Western Dead Man's Revenge.
Well, see, now I have to see it because Michael Ironside's in it.
Yeah, that's why I included that one for sure. Okay, the writer. So Bloodsong is based on a short story by a guy named by Joseph Schenck and George Hart. That's just the way it is. They haven't done anything else.
Okay.
the screenplay was written by James Fargo, Frank Avianca, and Lenny Montana. Fargo and Montana were also the producers for the movie. Interesting about these, though, is Fargo, one of the writers, directed The Enforcer from 1978, you know, the third from the Dirty Harry, Harry movies.
Yeah.
As well as Every Which Way But Loose in 1978. So he did a lot of Clint Eastwood working with. And then the co-writer, Frank Avianca, using the name Franco DiStefanino, went on to direct The Undertaker in 1988, starring the great Joe Spadell.
Oh, okay.
So very interesting. And the music. So music is by Rob Walsh, who, again, he did a ton of TV movies and television series, including a lot of animated films and cartoons like Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, G.I. Joe, The Transformers, X-Men, Muppet Babies, and the My Little Pony cartoons.
Muppet Babies.
Muppet Babies. So good. He did compose some other horror films scores like Leprechaun from 1993 and Night Beast from 1982, which has a fun score. In this movie, I mentioned it during the summary, but there is an original song called All in Your Mind, which is when Marion is walking the beach.
Yeah.
The lyrics, I mean, basically it's, you know, it's calling her crazy. And that's kind of like the whole angle in this movie. But that was composed and performed by Monty Turner. I forgot who the female singer was, but that movie is, I was looking for that song maybe to play at the end after the show, but it was pulled straight from the movie. So you hear like seagulls and shit going on.
Oh, okay.
Cinematography. Bloodsong was photographed by Steve Posey, who has some really cool credits. He did Jamal Fanaka's MMA, which I loved.
Yeah.
And Penitentiary, too.
Nice.
I highly recommend each of those films. Anything Fanaka directs is worth checking out. But both of those, MMA, the first Penitentiary, Penitentiary 2, they're all available on Blu-ray from Vinegar Syndrome. So pick it up.
Yeah.
Posey also shot The Slumber Party Massacre, the first one, directed by Amy Goodman, and Bloody Birthday from 1981, Savage Streets, starring Linda Blair, from 84, and Hellhole from 1985. And he photographed my favorite Friday the 13th film, A New Beginning. That is my favorite one by far. Not by far, but it's my favorite.
All right.
That's the crew. The cast. So Donna Wilkes stars as the teenager Marion Hauser, the young girl who receives the blood transfusion. She had a great run as an actress, like in the late 70s and 80s, landing a lot of TV series roles for The Incredible Hulk, Different Strokes, T.J. Hooker, and a recurring role on Days of Our Lives.
There it is.
I thought she looked familiar when I saw her. but she also did some films, Jaws 2, Schizoid, 1980, starring Klaus Kinski. She co-starred along Linda Blair and Tab Hunter in the very weird horror Grotesque from 1988. And another movie where you can pick up from Vinegar Syndrome, she plays the title character Angel from 1984, where she plays a 15-year-old high schooler, Molly Angel Stewart, who secretly earns her living as a prostitute. And that movie has a crazy performance from Susan Tyrell, so it's worth checking out.
Yeah. It's funny like that she played that role because she actually broke into Hollywood. Like she moved there and she was telling producers and people that she was older, but she was still like 16 or something like that. And by the time they figured it out, she was already 18 and they're like, well, I guess you're already here. So,
yeah, I mean, she's pretty much cast as a teenager because physically she looks so young.
Yeah.
I was trying to get her birthday and it's like on, it's different on like Wikipedia and IMDb, but it looks like she was born in 1958. Mm-hmm. Some sites said it was 61, but so she would have been like 22 for Bloodsong.
Yeah. And she looks like 15 in it.
She does. Yeah. She looks, I mean, all the movies that I'd watch, like with Angel, I watched Grotesque, Schizoid. She looks exactly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. She plays Klaus Kinski's. Well, no, I'm going to get to that later, I think.
All right.
I think we're going to be talking about that movie later, everybody. Mm. Okay. So Frankie Avalon plays the psychotic killer. Paul Foley is his name, but I don't know if it's ever uttered in the film other than that first flashback when they call him Polly. But apparently Bloodsong writer and producer Lenny Montana cast Avalon as the killer based on watching his performance in an episode of Fantasy Island. I looked up this episode because I was interested, like, okay, why, what does he play? I couldn't find it. I mean, I didn't spend much time looking for it, but the title of the episode is The Swinger / Terrors of the Mind from 1980. So I'm assuming he plays some sort of psycho. But Avalon is obviously known as being a 50s teenage heartthrob. Being a young crooner, he has all those songs about love and heartache. And he's also known for acting in most of those bikini beach party films from the 60s. He typically plays himself in most films and TV shows like Pee-wee's Playhouse, Christmas Special, Scorsese's Casino, Troop Beverly Hills, starring Shelley Long, and playing kind of a role of himself, Teen Angel in Grease, singing Beauty School Dropout.
Are you going to sing it?
Beauty school dropout, no graduation day for you, beauty school dropout. missed your midterms and flunk shampoo.
Wow. You know a lot of lyrics. I have like one.
I mean, that's really all. I don't, and I know like the repetitive beauty school dropout. The lyrics are funny, that song. Grease is a fun time. Grease 2, I like, because I like Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
Just a heads up. Avalon has another horror credit to his name, or a few others. The Haunted House of Horror from 1969, which was directed by Michael Armstrong, who directed Mark of the Devil. Mm-hmm. And he starred in the 1962 thriller Panic in Year Zero, directed by Ray Milland. He also, I think I saw you watched one of these, but he starred alongside Vincent Price. I don't think he saw this one, but Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine.
Yeah.
And then there was a sequel called Dr. Goldfoot and the Girl Bombs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Vincent Price is in that second one too, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
I didn't see the first one. I've heard that it's better than Girl Bombs, but it's just like this Italian comedic duo, and it's everything that I don't like about Austin Powers movies. It's spoofing those movies. Like that's what the Girl Bombs movies are supposed to be. But you know, you look at it on paper and you're like Vincent Price and Mario Bava and woo. And then you watch it and it's painful.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to watch, you know, Frankie Avalon movie, but I didn't. But I started Dr. Goldfoot and Bikini Machine, mm-hmm. and I was not in the mood for the humor, the real slap, like kind of Jerry Lewis all, hey, whoa. And I'm like, I can't. I don't want to right now.
That's what it is.
I saw Ishiro Honda. He's uncredited as a director for that movie.
What?
That's what, I mean, again, this is online. This could be completely false, but in IMDb, at least, he's listed as, I forgot who the real director's credited, but it has his name listed for Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine.
Huh.
That's why I pulled that movie. But again, I turned it on and I was like, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Okay. So Richard Jekyll plays Marion's angry father, Frank, who's great. He's another actor who's done a ton of TV series, but he also has roles in some great films like John Carpenter's Starman. He plays the national security director who wants to capture Jeff Bridges, dead or alive, and dissect him. Mm. He's Sergeant Bowren in The Dirty Dozen from 1967. He's in Delmer Daves' 310 to Yuma. I love Delmer Daves. Jubal is one of my favorite Westerns of all time. And Sam Peckinpah's 1973 Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. He also was in William Girdler's Grizzly and The Day of the Animals. He starred with Gregory Peck in The Gunfighter. He was in Airplane 2. Black Moon Rising? Bad Moon. Black Moon Rising.
Black Moon Rising, yeah.
With Tommy Lee Jones, yeah. And Linda Hamilton.
Yeah.
I did that one for Junesploitation not long ago.
That's right, yeah.
Antoinette Bauer plays...
Whoa. You did not bring up his greatest movie.
What is it?
The Green Slime.
Oh, The Green Slime. Yeah.
Have you not seen The Green Slime?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, my God.
It's streaming, too, all over the place.
And it has its own theme song. It's like this 60s rock, like, Green Slime.
I've heard that song, I believe. I think I was you know, looking through, you know, all the production notes here, and I saw The Green Slime, and I clicked on it, and I listened to that song, and it was very... It's queued up. I'll definitely watch it.
It's fantastic.
Something screaming across your mind. Green slime.
I can't believe you skipped that. Who are you?
I'm an idiot.
Moving on.
I had to cover Dr. Goldfoot and the Bikini Machine.
Yeah, apparently. That's important.
Okay. So Marion's mom's played by Antoinette Bauer. She played Mrs. Hammond in Prom Night from 1982. She was also in The Evil That Men Do with Charles Bronson. And she has mostly TV series credits. Although I probably missed one of her movies too, but let's see who we got. Okay. Joey, Marion's boyfriend. He's played wonderfully by William Kirby Cullen. And he doesn't really have any other movies. I found one credit, which kind of blew my mind, but he plays one of the freaks in John Waters' Multiple Maniacs from 1970.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Dan Clark plays the completely oblivious, non-caring sheriff. He's also in a lot of small roles, an American like television series. But I did find a quote that I liked, which was on his Wikipedia page. But he says he's a character actor who is known for playing, as he labeled himself, Joe Average. So basically, it's just the guy just in the background.
He's that guy.
Falling asleep in his office. So yeah, that's the cast and crew of Blood Song.
All right. We will get into our thoughts about the film right after this promo from our network.
You're listening to the Prescribed Films Podcast Network, home to hundreds of hours of free podcast entertainment. The shows on this network all have a common goal: providing you with the best discussions about movies and other forms of entertainment media. The PFPN hopes to fill your earholes with audio joy. Visit our website with links to all the other amazing shows at www.thepfpn.com. Thanks for listening.
So you didn't get into it when like going through cast and crew, and I don't know if you have it in your notes, but I know how this movie came to be. Somebody knew someone with a forklift.
You know, I thought you were going to be sincere, and that probably is true.
No, I'm not sincere, but I think I am right.
I did point that out in the summary, how all of a sudden Frankie Avalon's on a forklift and there's a night watchman who gets impaled on it. And that had to be brought up in the summary of this movie because it's probably the most exciting part of the film, realistically. The movie's pretty slow paced.
It is. And what was interesting, like when I was rewatching it this afternoon on like two or three times speed, just like to refresh my memory right before this. And her dad gets killed at like the hour mark. And then the rest of the movie is Frankie Avalon chasing after 30 minutes of him chasing after her.
Yeah. That sawmill chase scene.
It's so long.
It's way too long. It has like some of the best elements of the movie sprinkled throughout. Frankie Avalon goes hard on crazy.
Yeah.
I think he does a great job throughout the entire movie, but then he's making no sense. Basically, it's just like, Frankie, yell what you feel, you know, tell us what you're feeling as this character. And he's just yelling all these different emotions.
This is fun.
Yes, I love that. He's like, what was he saying? Like, yeah, he's driving this forklift laughing like, this is fun. Here I come. You know, I'm just like, this is the best. And he's like driving. He has no skill at all, like in this forklift, but he's having the best time in the world.
Right.
Then he shifts to like completely angry, like, I don't want to play anymore. And that's when Marion, her character shifts. There's a lot of weird shifts in character dynamic that make no sense. That's when she jumps on him and starts yelling, I hate you. You killed my dad. I'm going to kill you. And I'm like, whoa, where's this coming from? But maybe it's his blood that's causing her to do this. You know, she's getting the killer instinct.
I have a theory, but I'll save it. I'll save it for the end of this part. But you mentioned, you know, when in your summary too, like TV movie vibes and 100%. And yeah, like it makes sense given everyone that's involved with it, but just for everyone to know, there is plenty of gore in this and some nudity, but outside of that, it's full on. Like it looks and feels like a TV movie.
Yeah. I mean, I had to double check, like when I first started watching it, like, is this going to be a TV movie that, you know, isn't labeled as such, but yeah. Then I think Joey said shit pretty early on and I'm like, okay, there we go. And then the boobies came.
The boobies. Yeah.
But yeah, the gore is okay. The effects are okay.
Yeah.
But in the beginning shot, there's a cool gunshot wound to the head, you know, but that severed head looked good too, of the hitchhiker. Very, very maniac looking.
Yeah, I like that too.
Very fake looking, but it was good. It was effective.
Right. Yeah, I like it when it doesn't look completely realistic. Like, it's almost more endearing when it looks just a little bit fake. So
right, 100%.
I also did like the fact that Marion had a handicap, had a limp, and because that kind of made it a little bit more believable, or the stakes are a little bit higher when she's running away or trying to get away from something. Like,
right,
it added another element versus like running away and oops, I tripped on a root, you know, or I tripped on my own feet kind of thing. It's like, well, no, she's like legitimately slow because she's got a brace on her leg.
Yeah, and it added to the relationship with her dad, who mm-hmm. caused her to, you know, her inability to walk, which, you know, the dad is right when I love all assholes in horror films. I
mean,
it's just the same way it is. Like, you know, the douchebags in Primal Rage, you know, it's I could watch Frank the Dad just yell incoherently, and I'm definitely on Marion's side, but, you know, him just completely pissed off that she has a boyfriend. And what's funny is the boyfriend, he hates Joey because Joey's dad apparently hit on his wife. Do you remember that? They're talking about it.
Yeah.
I'm just like, this guy's just like a jealous, out of control freak who has no real remorse, you know, what happened to his daughter. Maybe he feels guilty because there's a weird kind of the dad redeeming himself angle that kind of comes into play, which doesn't work at all mm-hmm. for me. You know, like when they try to humanize him, like she comes home one night. I didn't mention in the summary, but she goes to the doctor and the doctor's like, guess what? The brace could come off, but you got to use this cane, you know? It's
like, which honestly, I think is kind of worse. I'm like, you know, at least with like a brace, it looks like, oh yeah, you've just like got like a metal cast kind of thing. You have a cane. It's like...
She was very excited. So
yeah, I mean, good for her, but I would be like, can I just keep the brace until my leg is done? I'd rather do that than the fucking cane. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, her friends too were like, oh, I'm so glad you got rid of that brace. I'm like, god damn. But
yeah, they're brace shamers.
But yeah, the scene where she comes home after and he finds her brace downstairs, and I guess he thinks maybe she snuck out. So he goes upstairs and sees her sleeping, and he goes to sit next to her. Like, it's kind of like humanizing him. Like, he's just staring at his daughter who he loves. And it just didn't work. And when he was fighting off the killer, when he was fighting off Frankie Avalon, and mm-hmm. he's telling Marion to run and she can't, I'm just like, come on, dude. You deserve to die. Let's watch it.
Right.
Know, don't try and save face. You're a scumbag.
Yeah. You're and I like watching him too, though. Like you said, like, obviously I'm rooting for Marion, but you know, the dad, Richard Jackal, is way more entertaining to watch. And that's why we love watching the assholes, because they're simply more entertaining. Marion isn't all that interesting. And she does flip every now and then, like you said. But there's this question of, like you said, is she crazy or is this all in her head and no one believing her, which is, it's a pretty common trope. And I don't know.
It tries too hard to focus on Marion being crazy, in my opinion, because I think it fails from the get-go, because you actually see what's happening. Like, maybe if you don't see all the behind-the-scenes stuff with Frankie Avalon's character, I'm going to keep calling him Frankie Avalon.
That's fine, yeah.
You know, actually doing what she's seeing, the crazy thing is immediately thrown out the window. So it's kind of, you know, and that's how the movie ends, and I get it. People perceive her as having these delusional dreams and visions. I don't know. I think it fails, like how it's delivered and how everybody doesn't believe her. And it's annoying.
It is. And I think so. And I was thinking about it and I was like, it could have been, if they didn't spend so much time with Frankie Avalon outside of her sort of, we'll call them mini visions or whatever they are, you could make a case for her being the killer the whole time. Right. With the exception of, say, the worker at the mental institution, because that's the only one where the police actually talk about it and say, oh yeah, this guy got killed at the mental institution. Frankie Avalon very, you know, could have easily killed that one person. And then all of this other stuff is in Marion's head and she's actually the killer. And she's jumping on the dock worker on the forklift thinking it's Frankie Avalon and screaming, "I hate you, I hate you," and killing him. And then at the very end, when Frankie Avalon gets into Joey's car, it could have just been like, he's just been fucking hitchhiking the whole time. He hasn't, you know?
Yeah, no, I think the whole idea, it's a fascinating concept. A madman's blood's donated to like an innocent girl who, you know, begins to see and experience what he sees.
Yeah.
But like what you just brought up, we need a remake of this idea, because I think that that does work better. And it, I don't know, maybe, well, no, probably not, but I was going to say maybe that's like the original vision that was they were kind of going for, because the stressing of her being crazy when everything else is clearly going on for the viewer just didn't work.
Yeah. And it makes sense too, like with her, like her dad's death, like the relationship that they have, like her finally just being like, you know what, fuck you, dad, and just, you know, hatcheting him up.
Yeah. That would have been cool. I feel like all the characters are just kind of so poorly written except for the dad. Because Frankie Avalon, you know, he's doing crazy, and I think he's doing crazy really well, but I think it's mainly due because he doesn't have a lot of direction from the character other than you saw your dad murder your mom and commit suicide. Nothing else really makes sense about the character. Like, he picks up this hitchhiker and he wants to start a relationship with her. What does that mean? I didn't get any of that. Like, why do they want to, like, I guess maybe it's some sort of lost companionship that he didn't have, or trust issues, or I don't know, but he's like, I want to go to San Francisco. We'll go to San Francisco and check the sites. And it just seemed real inconsistent. Or when he's killing Frank, Marion's dad, he starts yelling, "You're not my dad. My dad never hurt me." Like, you know, the crazy, aside from Frank, the dad, Frankie Avalon was great. I mean, I think Donna Wilkes was good too. I mean, she's pretty stale in this, but she was captivating enough. But Frankie Avalon does crazy really well. But I think it's just because the characters are so poorly conceived.
Yeah. I think like the main draw here is, if you're going to sell this movie to somebody, be like, Frankie Avalon is fucking off his rocker and killer in this movie. And it's that's like the primary draw for this movie. There's a moment, and it's not like he's not being creepy about it, but in context, it absolutely is, when he's at the gas station asking where the nearest high school is.
Yeah.
Like, and the gas station attendant's like, "Oh yeah, it's just right down the street here." And I'm like, oh my God, don't tell a strange man with a fucking van where the nearest high school is, please.
I mean, that's the 80s. I mean, people are just like, there's nothing wrong with that then. It seems like he always, like, even when he picked up the hitchhiker, he's like, "Hey man, where's the closest hotel?" You know, it's just like, he definitely had an agenda. You got to respect that.
Yeah. I mean, I have nothing but respect for it. But at the same time, I'm like, do red flags not exist?
But I did like Rob Walsh's original score. I think I was intrigued when I first listened to it, because right away it kicks off with like this, like a Mr. Bungle vibe throughout, like this weird circus music-y stuff. It has great 80 synth, but he plays around with so many, really every time he brings back that circus sound at the very end too. It seems like whenever they're in this mental institute, he's playing with this sound of just kind of lunacy. So it kind of made sense that he was involved in so many cartoons. Like, after I read that, I was like, okay, there was a part that he sounds like a poor man's, David Gilmour from Pink Floyd. Like, he's trying to hit those guitar solo notes and it just doesn't work. It just, I kept hearing like songs from The Final Cut, which is a great Pink Floyd album, everybody. But, I liked his score. And I think Night Beast might have a release on vinyl, but I kind of want a Blood Song print or a pressing. That way I can get that original song too, with no seagulls.
Oh.
Okay. We'll play it. That'll be our new, our intro music for this podcast.
No. Very funny. Well, so recommendations. So what'd you give this on Letterboxd?
So I gave this 3 stars and a heart. I watched this early one morning, the first time. I did a quick rewatch too, but, it felt like a, I think in my letterbox, I don't have it up, but I said, it felt like an appetizer of a horror film. Like if I went to some weird, like specialty programming festival and there was a 10 a.m. showing for the first movie and I was excited to start the festival and I went and saw this, I'd be like, oh, all right, this is good. Bring more on. It kind of put me in a good mood to start the day. Okay. and I, mainly because I loved all the characters, as underdeveloped as they might be, the actors kind of just played with what they had and it all kind of worked. And I loved that ending. That ending, I was interested in where it would go. And when they pulled out Bill DeWitt, the Night Watchman, I really didn't expect that. And I didn't realize it was going to go where it went with, you know, Marion being committed and then Frankie Avalon killing her, you know, it doesn't show up, but I'm sure he kills Joey and then goes to kill her.
Yeah.
I love that ending. So 3 stars out of me, I would definitely recommend it.
Okay.
How about you?
I gave it 2.5. I mean, I liked it. And again, I think I already said it, like the main draw here is Frankie Avalon off the rails. So I'd still recommend it for that reason. I think it's one of those things that it's interesting enough to watch. I don't think I'll ever rewatch it, but I do think that main draw makes it worth watching. So, and what about your double feature pairing for this one?
So I had a few picks, but I'm going to do what you did on one past episode. I'm going to pick my feature, but I have a short to go with it too.
Oh, okay.
Well, I'll do the short first. I'm going to say the eye segment from Body Bags, the anthology.
Okay.
Directed by John Carpenter and Toby Hooper. Toby Hooper, that's from 1993, Body Bags. It's on Shudder too. Everybody should watch it. Yeah. But Toby Hooper directed the eye segment, and it's Mark Hamill plays this baseball player who gets into a car accident, which damages his eye, and he undergoes an experimental surgical procedure, which involves a doctor played by Roger Corman, which is always great. But he goes through this procedure to replace his eye from a deceased man, which apparently came from a recently executed serial killer. So Hamill begins having these visions and nightmares of killing women and seeing what the serial killer saw. So it definitely kind of fit in with what Marion was going through. And it's a short little segment. Might as well watch the whole Body Bags. I mean, that could be the recommendation. But my actual double feature is Schizoid, which I brought up earlier.
Mm, yeah.
From 1980. Directed by David Paulson. And while the only connection here is really Donna Wilkes, who stars in it. But it's also like the weird, kind of as I mentioned, the weird characters and performances throughout Schizoid make this a fun pairing with Blood Song. It could be like a fun analysis of how actors shouldn't react. I mean, but that one stars Klaus Kinski. And I just got hooked by the characters and performances and any slow pacing or little action that both of these movies actually have. It's very slow, little action. It doesn't really matter to me if there's like time spent on these weird characters. I could just watch them react like in a very unrealistic way. Like their reactions will have like no impact on the overall story. It's just hilarious to me.
Okay.
But yeah, they seem to kind of share those components. It's a weird slasher type murder mystery that involves a killer whose weapon of choice is a pair of scissors, but he or she begins murdering off people, seeing a therapist who's played by Klaus Kinski. Because when you think of a therapist, you immediately think of casting Klaus Kinski. And Donna Wilkes plays his daughter, and she's really kind of a badass in it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than Blood Song, honestly. But I would I'd watch Blood Song, then I would watch. Well, no, I'd watch Schizoid, then Blood Song, because Blood Song has that Frankie Avalon ending.
Okay.
How about you?
Okay, so my double feature is a pop star in a horror movie double feature. So I picked Night of the Strangler from 1972. This has a AGFA DVD release and it stars Mickey Dolenz from the Monkees. It is a movie that almost defies being categorized. The best I can do is to call it a Hicksploitation murder mystery. There is very Southern fried racism going on in it.
There's giallo elements in it. It's, yeah, I'm going with Hicksploitation murder mystery. I don't want to say too much about it because it is a murder mystery, but I will say that Night of the Strangler does not take place in one night and there is very little strangulation. good title though. So yeah, AGFA has a DVD release of that. You can get that on Vinegar Syndrome. And I honestly think I put it on our list as a potential movie to cover.
Oh, nice.
For the show, because it can get uncomfortable to watch at certain points, but I think it's the ending is really satisfying. And but I still think, and I think it would be kind of a good balance because it is like an uncomfortable movie and you've got Frankie Avalon being like, you know, hamming it up and like having a lot of fun, but you still have like these two odd pop stars being in these really, these movies that are completely outside of who you think they are. So.
Right. Cool. That's a good pick.
Yeah.
What's your next pick for the episode?
Okay. So next episode's movie. So I was thinking, since, you know, you picked a movie called Blood Song and we're in, you know, we're in April now. And I was thinking, what goes on in April? And I was like, April showers. And then I was like, let's do April showers of blood. So yes. I picked a movie that also has the word blood in the title. It is a late 80s Italian movie called Blood Delirium. And as of this recording, it has 101 views on Letterboxd. And Lance, I think you're going to like this one. So after his beloved wife dies, an unbalanced painter who believes himself to be the reincarnation of Vincent van Gogh goes over the edge and digs up her corpse with the help of his necrophiliac butler to bring back to his castle and use that corpse for inspiration. That plan soon falls apart. He then meets a beautiful musician who looks exactly like his late wife, who prior to this has had a supernatural encounter with the spirit of the dead wife. Anyway, he meets her, takes her back to his castle. She eventually discovers that the butler and the painter have this deep, dark secret that the butler is murdering young women, butchering them up, and basically draining them of their blood so that the painter can use their blood for the artist's paintings. There's a lot of weird supernatural elements going on. And of course, one of my favorite things in movies, necrophilia. I'm going to have a really hard time when we do this and in the summary. So it's one of those kinds of movies. So if I had to compare it to something that would be difficult to summarize, I think Cozzi's The Black Cat. Okay.
Oh, yeah, I'm going to love this.
Yeah, that's what I think so. And I was like, oh, it's got a painter in it. Lance is an artist. And, you know, we'll see. So there is a cut version of this on YouTube. It is dubbed in English with Japanese subtitles, and it pretty much cropped out all of the tits and gore. So Lance, I'll send you the bootleg full version. So you'll have that. Yes, but for listeners, sorry, you're going to have to deal with no boobies if you want to watch the movie, or, you know, go through your own personal legal adjacent means for it. I'm not going to, no judgment here. So, and this month, we are also going to throw a bonus episode at you. We've talked before about, like, you know, physical media purchases when the sales come up. So like Last Vinegar Syndrome sale, Lance and I both kind of talked about, you know, what did we buy? And we thought it would be fun for us to do just a quick bonus episode with our wish list of Blu-rays. Like, what movies that have not gotten Blu-ray releases yet would we like to see? So we're each going to come in with a list. We'll share those. And so you can look forward to that later this month.
This will be fun.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm going to try and make people uncomfortable with my picks. I'm just saying.
You always do. I mean, no, don't try. Just be yourself.
All necrophilia movies, people.
Google, movies where kids die. There's Erica's picks.
All right. So look forward to that. And if you are not already, please give us a follow on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, all at Unsung Horrors. You can follow me on Letterboxd under the username Also Watched. You can also follow my other podcast, Customers Also Watched, on Twitter at CAW Podcast or Facebook or Instagram under Customers Also Watched. Lance, where can people find and follow you?
I'm L. Scheibe, Letterboxd, Twitter, and Instagram.
Well, thanks everyone once again for listening. We'll see you back for Blood Delirium. Night, y'all.
Bye, everyone.